Hi, this is Richard Edelman, and you're listening to The Trust Makers.
Hi, I'm Justin Blake, Executive Director of the Edelman Trust Institute and Global Chair of Executive Positioning at Edelman. We recently launched Edelman's Trust Barometer Special Report, Trust and Health, which found that good health feels out of reach for most people and that cost is the main barrier to taking better care of themselves. We also found that consumers have an increasingly expansive definition of health and are empowering themselves with health information. To dive deeper into these findings and to discuss the intersection of trust and health, I'm joined by Mark Henderson. Mark is the Director of Corporate Affairs at Wellcome, which works to improve health by funding research, leading policy and advocacy campaigns, and building global partnerships. Wellcome is the second highest spending charitable foundation in the world. Mark, welcome to the Trust Makers.
Good to be on here, Justin.
To ground the conversation, Mark, why don't you talk a little bit about the work of Wellcome?
Delighted to. So Wellcome is, as you've just said, the second highest spending charitable foundation in the world. We've been around for a long time, for 80 plus years, but really we've been a significant force in the last 20 or 30. We now have an endowment of about £38 billion. That's what, about $55 billion. And we spend £1.6 billion a year, just over $2 billion. Our mission is improving health, and we do that through science. We're principally a funder of science, and then we also work very much on the principle that science is necessary to make progress against health, but it's not sufficient. You need to make sure that that science has impact in the world, that it's implemented into public policy, that it's communicated critically, that it's trusted, that it works in the interests of the people it's meant to benefit. So that's really Wellcome. We have four areas of work, principally. We work on what we call discovery research, which is the really support of science that could go anywhere. It's the breakthroughs. We don't know what they're going to be yet. They're going to improve health, but we don't yet know how. Alongside that, we've also identified three major health challenges in the world today that we are taking a much more intentional approach towards. And those are infectious disease, climate and health, the intersections between climate change and human health, and mental health.
Great. I feel like we could do a podcast on any one of those topics and the intersection of them. I know you actually talk a lot about the intersection of those areas and that health no longer stands alone, which is very much one of the findings of our special report. Can you talk a little bit about how people have broadened their definition of health and how you're looking at that?
Sure. Well, I certainly thought it was one of the striking findings of the Trust report that you've just put out, that mental health features so highly as a key component of overall health. Indeed, higher than physical health. And I found that to be really interesting. It doesn't surprise me. And one of the reasons it doesn't surprise me is it concords with our own research at Wellcome. So we do a report called the Wellcome Global Monitor, which is an international survey, not so much a trust in health, but trust in science. And when we did that recently, we found that 92% of the respondents globally rated mental health as either as important or more important than physical health. So very much off a piece, I think, with your findings. I think that really builds into a growing perception that mental health, the health of the whole person, is not just the absence of physical impairment and illness. It's much broader than that. When it comes to Wellcome strategy, one of the things that we are really taking on within mental health is the fact that the progress of science towards developing better interventions for making sure that people aren't held back by mental health problems, the progress of that science has been nothing like as successful in recent years as it has been for physical health. And that's something that we are really very much trying to take on and to recognize that we need to be taking a sort of interdisciplinary scientific approach to mental health in the same way that we would to something like cancer.
seems like one other way of supporting people's mental health is through the workplace. And right now, the only trusted institution around health is my own employer. Can you talk a little bit about what you think the employer role is around mental health?
Well, we spend so much time at work, and it's such a significant source of the environmental factors that are together with other factors to form and to influence our mental health, that it's hard to imagine, really, that what you do in the workplace cannot but be extraordinarily significant for mental health. It's something I think that all employers are increasingly engaging with: workplace well-being, support via apps or services or whatever, but also in terms of working culture. And I think one of the most important things that leaders of organizations can do in respect to this is actually to role model self-care and to role model the approaches to looking after your mental health that we would ideally want everybody to do. If you have a holiday vacation policy that your CEO does not use themselves, if they don't take their annual leave entitlement, other members of your team are going to emulate you. And that may not be great for burnout in the organization. My until recently boss, Jeremy Farrar, set a really brilliant tone, actually, where he instituted very much off his own bat and against the skepticism of some executives, including me, a rule that he wouldn't email after 7 o'clock in the evening or at weekends. And that really stuck. And it really changed the boundaries between work time and non-work time. And I think had a very important effect protecting mental health, especially in the pandemic, actually, where when we all moved into suddenly working from home.
I love that you gave that very specific example of how Jeremy was creating boundaries around email. And what you're talking about here is very much supported by the data. 78% of respondents say CEOs have a particular responsibility to model healthy behavior by respecting work-life boundaries and taking their PTO. Not every CEO does that. What are the barriers to CEOs modeling this kind of behavior?
Being a CEO is a different job to most other jobs, and it isn't always on job to an extent. And that must be an enormous barrier to a number of people. But I mean, it is my firm view that even CEOs are more effective when they take time off. Nobody can do 100% efficient work for every hour of every day. It's just not humanly possible. But that surely must be one of the biggest barriers. I really think it's overcomable. I think that demonstrating the effectiveness of work rather than the volume of work must be one of the best things that people can do in this respect.
Yeah, and I would say privately, since the pandemic, more CEOs are also willing to have conversations behind closed doors and with trusted advisors about their own mental health. That feels a little bit different, that there's almost permission to have those quiet discussions.
Absolutely. And there are some very prominent business people who have come out really in public about their mental health issues. And Antonio Horta-Osorio, for example, would be a great example of that.
One of the most striking findings from the health report is that since the last year, trust in friends and family on health issues has risen 11 points to 76%. Can you talk a little bit about the ramifications of that rise?
I mean, you're right. It's astonishing. And especially when you see that in some segments of the analysis, the level of trust in friends and family is comparable to the level of trust in medical professionals. I mean, it is a really astonishing finding. I think that some of what may lie behind it is also there in your data, because one of the other findings I found really striking was the series of questions that asked people what would make them trust more and what would make them trust health information. And the overarching theme of that was that people will trust when they're treated as equals and when they're treated as partners in the management of their health and the influence of their health, rather than as sort of passive vessels for information and being told what to do especially then when they're uncertain that what they're being told to do is actually in their best interests rather than in the best interest of somebody else. For me, this was so arresting and interesting when your findings that 60% were saying, include me in the science so that I can be confident that the science is actually being developed with people like me. Show how it fits my life, 62%. Give me a voice, 67%. These are the ways that one builds trust. And overall, I'm sure that's what's happening with this friends and family thing, because friends and family listen, they discuss, they are generally people who show you unequivocal love and support. They're people who you know have your best interests at heart. And I think that makes them more trustworthy in a certain way. Medical professionals, others can reach that level of trust. And indeed, I think with the higher trust group in your study, very successful in achieving that. But I think it was so interesting seeing again that when you looked at that lower trust, what was going to build trust? Let me ask questions. There's so much emerging evidence, I think, not just in healthcare, that this is really the new secret source of influencing people, is to win their trust by building rapport and by making it clear that you're not judging them. I think that many people feel when they're being given health advice that they are being judged, and that makes them less likely to accept and trust the advice. When they're discussing their health with friends and family, they don't feel they're being judged. Bizarrely, another group who I think people feel that they're not being judged by often are people on the fringes of medicine, anti-vaccine activists, conspiracy theorists, etc. One of the reasons I think those are so successful is they meet people where they are. They allow people to feel that they are being listened to, that they're being respected, that they're being treated as equals. And that's a really powerful communication tool. Now, what we don't want to do as people who are interested in sound health information is to take on the full approach of that. But I think we do have something to learn from the meeting people where they are, asking questions, taking a discursive approach to health rather than simply an informative one.
So this kind of two-way relationship around health information is something that you've been talking about well before this study came out. Talk a little bit about some of the tactics that you've been using.
It's something we're only really starting to play with at Wellcome in the communication sense. I've found just recently there's a fantastic book by David McCraney, How Minds Change, which came out recently, which really goes into this subject in some depth and talking about how, for example, the campaign for gay marriage in the US and elsewhere, how this sort of motivational interviewing, asking people questions in order to persuade about why they believe what they do, is a far more effective way of getting them to question what they believe and potentially to change their minds than to argue with them with facts, and to give people an opportunity to think around a problem, to really ask themselves questions they wouldn't have asked, is a very effective methodology there. I think the other thing that we're doing a lot at Wellcome and that we believe in very strongly is, it goes back to that include me in the science point that came out of your survey. We believe very strongly in community engagement upstream of the science that we support. So not just engaging people with the findings of research, but actually engaging people with the design of research. What are the questions we need to be asking? How do we ensure that in an area like climate and health, for example, that the scientific questions we're actually exploring are the ones that are most relevant to the communities that are most affected by climate change and most likely to have their health put at risk by climate change? That, I think, is a really important way of building that confidence that science is working in the interests of the people it's meant to serve.
It's clearly a great foundational way of building that trust. But going back to the point about communicating through almost a discourse, how do you do that at scale?
I wish I knew the answer. I think that is actually one of the most important questions for those of us who are in the business of communicating health and communicating other matters of public interest at, at the moment is how do you scale this technique? Because it isn't immediately obvious how it can easily be done. I imagine that some of the answer must be in distributed networks. How can we use the power of friends and family as messengers? How can we use the power of the peer group to spread these positive messages, science-based messages, reasoned messages? That is such a powerful way of doing it.
You mentioned that the often effectiveness of the style of anti-vaxxers and some others. Is there a way to take some of the style of anti-vaxxers and other groups and kind of help seed that with sources that you're really trying to get out there to behave more like friends and family?
I think the trick is not judging. I think some of the successful anti-vax groups do is they don't judge people, and they take great care not to suggest that believing what they want you to believe is in any way threatening to other beliefs that people may hold more sacred. And that is often something that those of us who are trying to communicate science and health forget. And if you put people in the position of having to choose between an allegiance to their family, to their core beliefs, whether they're religious beliefs or political attachments or whatever, and the science, they're going to choose their fundamental values and they're going to reject the science. And we have to get better, I think, at recognizing that and presenting health information in a way that is more neutral in that respect. And that comes from a position of recognizing as agency, everybody as partner.
Is there something implicitly judgmental about the way scientists even portray themselves? I guess part of what I'm asking is, once you put on a lab coat, are there people who are automatically going to think that person is somehow judging you because they're seen as more expert in a way?
Sadly, unfortunately, I think that is the case. I think COVID has really made that worse in the sense that if you know that somebody is anti-masks, anti-vaccination, and anti-lockdown, you probably have now a fair view as to what their views on climate change and racial politics and probably who they voted for are as well. And that is terrifying in many ways, because health information shouldn't be aligned on political grounds in that way, and yet it is. So some of this is a result of bad actors weaponizing things for cultural war purposes. But some of it too is that increasingly people are seeing themselves as members of a particular identity with a set of beliefs that come through there. And if those beliefs are not respected and those beliefs are looked down on or approached in a way that is seen as patronizing or authoritarian, they're likely to react against it. There have to be better ways of communicating in a way that takes that into account. And one of the things that David McCraney writes about most powerfully in his book is the power of making a connection, that people who are trying to persuade achieve that much more effectively when they are able to build a rapport with the person who they're talking to that establishes some common ground, whether it's about a love of sport or music or something that people can share their humanity over. And that then opens the space for them to listen and to question. I think in how we communicate health, we need to be thinking about how we do that more effectively than we've done to date.
It almost seems like the most effective messengers for changing people's minds are people who already share other ideological beliefs. Is there an opening there?
There may well be. We do need to be a bit careful about that, because we don't want to reinforce this connection between a set of beliefs about health and a set of beliefs around politics that has, I think, become very damaging. However, there's room for exploration here. I think it's very interesting to see how, for example, during the Ebola epidemic of 2014-15, religious groups and community groups were incredibly powerful messengers about safe practices far more effective often than medical messengers were. It's taking the people who are trusted for different reasons and co-opting that trust for medical information.
Sticking with the topic of trusted information, trust in the media's healthcare reporting has plummeted 7 points since 2019. So since the pandemic, from your perspective, why is that happening and why is that important?
It's another unfortunate finding. The media is potentially a really important source of accurate and trustworthy information. I think there are a few things going on here. The first one, sad to say, is that much of the media has not been particularly reliable in the way that it has transmitted health information. I used to be a science journalist before I joined Wellcome. And even then, there was a large variance in the seriousness with which media organizations took fact-checking about medical information. That is even more the case now. And I can think of a large number of examples of exceptionally poor reporting about medicine over the past few years. Obviously, much of it about COVID, but not all of it about COVID. So some of this is actually justified. I think, though, something else that's deeply worrying here is I think there's two different things going on. There's mistrust in the medical information in the media that deserves to be mistrusted, but there's also mistrust in the accurate medical information in the media, which is now not being trusted by people who are perhaps predisposed not to trust the media for reasons that come back into that kind of tribal alignment that is starting to conflate medical information with more political viewpoints. I found it really interesting too that in the survey there was a huge spike in the number of people who said they were educating themselves around medical information that they had been fed or trying to verify medical information that they've been told. Now, on the face of it, that's a really positive finding. I'm not sure it is a really positive finding because I would be extremely interested to find out how that breaks down between people who are trying to verify medical information that is fundamentally untrustworthy and people who are trying to, quote, verify information that is actually really well attested and peer-reviewed and based on science, but challenged from other groups for different reasons.
So then how do people accurately verify health information?
There are some really good sources out there, many of them available very easily by the internet. The majority of health information that is provided by public healthcare and private healthcare providers is very, very, very good. You will get outstanding information about your health on the NHS website in the UK or the websites of large hospitals in the US, etc.
To put several strands of this conversation together, you mentioned very trusted information sources from national health authorities and hospitals, for example. How does that information actually get into consumers' hands, though? There aren't a lot of people that are necessarily looking at those websites and such. So is there a way that either through your own employer or through actual friends and families or other trusted sources that really legitimate, important health information can get into people's hands?
I think people do look up those sources when they're researching something specific that's wrong with them or that's worrying them or whatever. I do think there's a really interesting potential role, though, for other messengers. I was really struck in the research by the finding that among those with the lowest trust, the channel that they thought they would trust most was health information provided by their employer. And I think that is potentially something that is an exciting route for health information to explore more. I think you can see virtue in it from a number of different angles. First of all, there's demand. Employers, I think, are increasingly asking themselves, what can we do for our employees in terms of health? Employees are increasingly, I think, demanding from their employer that they are given benefits that go beyond their salary and their time off and help to look after them as whole people, including their health. And employers, I think, have sometimes been a little bit of a loss as to what they can do about that. This is a way that I think they could really lean into that challenge, providing that level of health information that perhaps is verified, that is designed in a way that is easily communicable to large numbers of people, and that employers can be the final chain in the transmission onwards to the audience that we want, because they're the most trusted messenger. I think there's a really powerful opportunity here.
The potential role of employers in helping their own employees' health seems a perfect way to close this conversation. Mark, you're as great as always talking to you. Thank you so much for your time. And to our listeners, thank you for listening to The Trustmakers.
Thank you for tuning into The Trustmakers, an Edelman podcast in partnership with Advertising Week, where we speak with leaders and other trust builders across institutions. See you next time.